I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, saying, "Come and see."
Noise of Thunder Radio with Christian J. Pinto.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we're going to talk about a situation in California, and from there, we're going to go over a little bit more history of the Jesuit order. We've been talking about that here since Hillary chose her Jesuit-educated vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, and it was something I've been meaning to talk about for a while. As soon as I learned about it, is the fact that Governor Jerry Brown out in California was Jesuit educated. He graduated from St. Ignatius High School in 1955 and entered the Sacred Heart Novitiate, a Jesuit seminary. He later attended the University of California, Berkeley, graduating in 1961 before earning a JD at Yale Law School in 1964. All right, so Jerry Brown, the governor of California. Now, interesting, right now in California, they've had all of these, just a radical left-wing agenda going on out in California. Very radical left-wing agenda going on out there. Now, Breitbart is reporting that the California Assembly declares August Muslim Appreciation Month. Muslim Appreciation Month. And this, of course, would be part of the tolerance movement. That the problem is not that Islam is radical or dangerous or anything like that. And of course, you study this bill in the Breitbart article. Basically, what they're saying is that the real problem is not Islam or its faith or anything like that. It's all of the anti-Muslim sentiment, the lack of charity toward Muslims in America since 9/11, that's the real problem. So now they're going to dedicate an entire month. The month of August is going to be Muslim Appreciation Month. And to me, that is very much, it is a very Jesuitical thing to imply or to set up or to promote. Now, why do I say that? Well, it's very important to remember the purpose of tolerance. You have two types of tolerance in the historically. The Protestant form of tolerance you can trace to Samuel Adams, Sam Adams, and his Rights of the Colonists, 1772. Talked about how tolerance is to be extended unto all whose beliefs are not hostile or subversive to the powers of the state or of society. That's the idea. In other words, if people aren't doing any harm, even if they have some strange belief or something like that you don't agree with, but if they're not harming anybody, they're not subversive, they're not hostile because of their belief, then tolerance should be extended to them. But you don't extend tolerance to people who don't fall into that category, people whose beliefs compel them to be hostile and subversive. That's the original Christian understanding of tolerance. Now, what happened is, through the Middle Ages, the Jesuits got hold of this idea of tolerance, and they began to employ it as a weapon. And you've got a number of different writers and historians who have talked about this. I know if you read the writings of J.C. Ryle in the 19th century, and then today we're going to go over some of this from J.A. Wiley, James Atkin Wiley, who wrote a number of books. He wrote, we talked about it on the last program, he wrote The History of Protestantism. He's got a book on the papacy, and he's got this book that we're going to read from again here, The Jesuits, Their Moral Maxims and Plots, etc. And he talks about, in one chapter, he talks about what went on in the days of Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, and they had the English Civil War during the time of King Charles I. And it was suspected that Charles I was going to try and take the country, take England back to Rome. Of course, they had disentangled themselves from Rome through the Protestant Reformation. And this, they had become a firmly Protestant country through the time of Queen Elizabeth I. But then when Queen Elizabeth passed away, the power struggle began again through a series of monarchs. But Charles I, and I found it interesting, Wiley says in his history, he says whether or not Charles intended to take England back to Rome cannot be fully known. There were some who said yes, others who said, well, not necessarily. But nevertheless, he was ultimately condemned as a traitor and put to death. He was executed. They cut his head off. But then his successor, Charles II, you had Charles I, he was executed. Then Cromwell becomes the Lord Protector of England. And then after Cromwell, they tried to continue the protectorate through Cromwell's son. That didn't work, and so all of that was overturned, and then King Charles II came in. And here's what Wiley says in his book. He says, quote, "The restoration of Charles II was followed by a revival of the hopes of the Jesuits and a fresh outburst of Jesuit activity." Why? Because Charles was sympathetic to their cause. Sympathetic to their cause. But notice what he says. He says, quote, "Their cry now was for a general toleration." Their cry now was for a general toleration. Pius IX condemned toleration and taught that rulers sin mortally if they suffer any religion save the Roman to exist in their dominions. But infallible dogmas are true or false as it suits the interest of the church. Interestingly, you know, another quote that you'll find among historians, they talk about how the Jesuits will either affirm or deny whatever they need to advance their aims. And this seems to be along those lines. So Wiley says, quote, "In the days of Charles II, the papists needed toleration in order to set up publicly the ceremonial of their worship in England. And therefore, toleration was orthodox." So what he's saying is, even though the whole concept of toleration was really against the papacy, like Pius IX, they don't really believe in toleration. Toleration is something, it's an instrument that they employ so they can gain access. So they can set up, as he says, they needed toleration to set up publicly the ceremonial of their worship in England. That's what they needed. So they pleaded toleration so they could gain access to power, access to set up their worship in England. And therefore, toleration was orthodox. And though meanwhile the Protestants would share in the boon, the Romanists looked forward to the day when they should be able to tell them that toleration was a luxury never meant for heretics. In other words, they're going to preach tolerance long enough to get what they want, and then they're going to turn around and they're going to tell the Protestants, well, no, we're not going to have any tolerance for you. Does this sound familiar? Does this sound like the direction certain things, certain movements are headed in our country today, where you've had groups that have preached toleration, tolerance, 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 and now once they begin to gain access to power and so on, they turn, and now they want to completely wipe out tolerance for anyone else. Interesting. All right, so Wiley says, quote, "The Jesuits strove therefore to widen the breach betwixt the Church of England and the nonconformists, in order that the cry for toleration for tender consciences might wax yet louder and the door be opened for the restoration of the Popish Church." Now that phrase, I think, perfectly describes the entire tolerance movement. The cry for toleration for tender consciences might wax yet louder and louder, and the door be opened. This is what it's intended to do, to get your foot in the door. And it's to open the door to these subversive groups. And I mean, chiefly the Jesuits. They're using it for their own purposes here. But think about what's been going on in the entire Western world with this situation with Islam. The cry for tolerance and toleration and so on, that is what has opened the door to this massive flood of Islamic immigrants into these different countries. And so even though Western countries have every reason in the world to have a ban on having any more Muslims come into their countries, because when you have the buildup of the Islamic population, they will become increasingly hostile. Right now in the news, there's this whole conflict because between Trump and an Islamic family who had a son who died in the military. And they're, you know, trying to use this, the Democrats are trying to use this to say that Muslims are American patriots, et cetera, and this kind of thing. But what they're doing, of course, is very, very misleading. It doesn't change the fact that in one country after another, whenever you have a buildup of the Islamic population, when you're getting hundreds of thousands and millions of Muslims all in one area, they are going to change the cultural climate. They're going to build their mosques, et cetera. They're going to have their groups, and they're going to begin to demand that the people around them conform to Islam. This is what they've done over and over and over again. And you've had Christian countries throughout history, like Egypt, like the Sudan, and so on, that were Christian countries for centuries and centuries and were eventually overrun by Islam. Why? Because they had immigrants. They had Muslim immigrants that came in a little bit at a time, a little bit of time, a little bit of time. This is what happened to Lebanon in the 20th century. Lebanon used to be a Christian country with a Christian constitution. But it was the tolerance argument that was used to get more and more Muslims into that country. And then one day they started a civil war. So the instrument of using toleration in this way, you can trace to the Jesuits over and over again. And of course, I believe they very likely have everything to do with that movement in our country right now and throughout the Western world. And this has got to be undoubtedly what Hillary and the Democrats have in mind with her vice presidential running mate, Tim Kaine, that they're going to pursue this whole leftist agenda using and employing these same methods to open the doors of America to subversive groups. I mean, they brought in all of the illegal aliens. Think about it. The arguments in favor of allowing illegals to come into the country from Mexico is all based on arguments of toleration. That's the argument that they use. And then they're flooding the country with hundreds of thousands and millions of these immigrants and changing the dynamics of America one step at a time. But the argument that they use is toleration. Chiefly. All right, let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk more right after this.
Christian Film Ministry, Adalam Films presents A Lamp in the Dark, the untold history of the Bible. Enter into a world of saints and martyrs battling spies, assassins and wolves in sheep's clothing. A Lamp in the Dark unfolds the fascinating history, the Bible, and the lives of the saints who fought to preserve it. A Lamp in the Dark is an epic documentary, a powerful witnessing tool for church and Bible study groups around the world. Share with your church, your family, and friends the untold history of the Bible today. Now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Noise of Thunder Radio.
Okay. Okay, we are back. Praise the Lord, you guys. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we're continuing some of our conversation about the Jesuits in history and in America. Why? Because I think it's a very pertinent topic. I've talked about on the last show how we've got many Jesuit-educated people in Congress today. Now you've got a Jesuit-educated vice presidential candidate. We've got a Jesuit-educated head of the CIA. California has a Jesuit-educated governor, Jerry Brown. And wherever you have Jesuits in power or those who have been under their influence, you quite often have this very left-leaning agenda. Because if you trace it throughout history, it's entirely the social justice, socialism, communism, all of this was developed by the order over time, especially through the 19th century. And so it's interesting to study the history, and in particular, the history of the order prior to the 20th century. If you've never listened to our radio show before, if you're new to it from Worldview Weekend and so on, one of the things that I talk about where history is concerned is I personally believe if you're going to study the history of the past, anything that happened prior to the 20th century, you've got to go to history books that were written typically prior to the 1920s and 30s. And the reason is because it's during that time that the tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Guggenheim, and the Carnegie Endowment, it's from that time onward that they began to slowly, systematically rewrite the history books in our education system and in our country. And this was uncovered by the Rees Committee in the 1950s. The Rees Committee was a congressional committee. And so when you're reading history books about, like if you read any modern history book, like a mainstream book that has to do with the Jesuit order, they're not going to tell you typically that this is the most nefarious society that great leaders of the world and historians and so on have all warned about the Jesuits for hundreds of years. You might get one of them to maybe tell you that John Adams once said, you know, I know of no body of men more deserving of eternal damnation on earth or in hell than the sons of Loyola. Words to that effect. I'm paraphrasing him. But you have these kind of quotes throughout history from well-known figures like John Adams, like Napoleon Bonaparte, like the Marquis de Lafayette, and others talking about the order. And so today, when people are Jesuit educated or somebody's a Jesuit priest, etc., it's talked about in a very lighthearted manner. The order is highly respected. You know, they have a lot of confidence. You know, people have confidence in them, etc. Typically, there's no mention, at least in the mainstream, about their very dark and troubled, sinister history of deception and infiltrating and overthrowing countries from within. The fact that they've been driven out of one country after another throughout the Middle Ages. That's not typically talked about. There are some people who will talk about it, but it's I believe it's the result of the massive rewrite of our history books. That's the reason. That's the reason. But if you go back prior to the 20th century, especially, the Jesuits are absolutely nefarious. Absolutely nefarious. All right. So we were talking about, before we went to the break, here in Wiley's book from 1881. Bear this in mind. All this stuff that Wiley's writing about on toleration, he's talking about back in 1881. And how Rome and her Jesuits use toleration, that argument, to gain access, to open doors to power. And so Wiley talks about their relationship with King Charles II. They had great hopes for him. They thought he was going to give them what they wanted. But it says, concerning Charles, it says, quote, but he was too much the sensualist to risk his throne for any religion whatsoever. And so the Jesuits, hoping to find in his brother James a more willing tool, gave Charles his viaticum in what is known to the Italians as a draft of the Acqua Tofana, which is a very deadly poison. In other words, they poisoned him and killed him. And that is something that the Jesuits are known for throughout history. They've been known for poisoning popes. Pope Clement abolished them, abolished the order in 1773, and they poisoned him a year later. Go and study the history of Pope John Paul I. Pope John Paul I, who reigned for a very short period of time and then died suddenly without an autopsy. And to this day, it's generally believed that he was poisoned. And the reason generally is because he was said to be a nice guy and really wasn't going to play along with the politics and the intrigues that the Jesuits had in mind in Rome. And so it is generally thought, from what I've read on it, that that was the reason that they just allegedly got rid of him. All right, so Wiley now is talking about how they basically did this with King Charles II. They, according to Wiley, they poisoned him, and then James II, his successor, comes to the throne. Now, King James II, this is a very interesting part of history, brethren. This is one that you'll find one historian writing about over and over and over again. Because what would happen with King James II, this would all lead to the glorious revolution of 1688, the conflict that would come about. James II would eventually be driven off the throne, and then they would bring in the great Protestant champions, William and Mary, and they would come in and restore Protestantism to England. And that is the reason why we have the College of William and Mary in our country today. It's in memory of these events where James, who was perceived to be a Jesuit pawn, was driven out of the country because it was obvious he was setting things up in such a way to subvert England, presumably to take it back to Rome. And the thing that got him was that he set forth an edict of toleration. So again, this idea of tolerance. But then he used that as a weapon to remove Protestants from power and to replace them with his henchmen who were going to do, you know, all of his dirty work. And the English are watching all of this, and they became very alarmed. Now, this is a fascinating period of history. If you read the book To Keep and Bear Arms, a considerable amount of time is spent talking about this particular period of history, where you've got James II, the Glorious Revolution, etc., because the issues of the right to keep and bear arms and so on were right in the midst of all of this. And on the other side of it, after the Glorious Revolution happens and so on, this is where Protestants became very, very adamant that they had to have the right to keep and bear arms. Now, incredibly, part of what was so glorious about the Glorious Revolution is it never came to an armed conflict. But it was a game of political intrigue. And what ends up happening, from what I read on it, is James realized that all the chess pieces were moving against him and there was really nothing he could do. And so he had to flee the country. And then William and Mary come in. But it was for Protestants, it was a very close call. From what I can tell, they were envisioning a return to the days of Bloody Mary and this kind of thing, where it was just a matter of time before James was going to unleash some kind of inquisition. And that's why he was manipulating the politics that way. So you see, brethren, when we've got people in the country today who are concerned about totalitarian powers rising up and subjecting the people to tyranny, this concern is most certainly not something that is unique to our generation. If you study history, you can go back hundreds of years. That concern has been held by God-fearing Christian people one century after another, especially through the time of the Reformation up into modern times. But to me, the history is fascinating, and many of these elements we can see being repeated. The shadows of them have come into the modern world. All right, brethren, we are going to wrap it up there. We lift these things up to God, and we trust that all things work together for good to those who love Him. Praise the Lord. All right, brethren, that's going to do it for us today. That is our show. We'll stop it there, but we will be back next time as the Lord leads us. Until then, God bless you guys. I'm Chris Pinto, and you've been listening to Noise of Thunder Radio.